You know the drill by now. There will be spoilers in this podcast for, in this case, episode 7 of season 2 of Star Trek Picard. And if you don't want to hear those spoilers, you should watch the episode first before you listen to this silly little podcast. Also, if you don't care about Star Trek at all, you should jump to the timestamp that the series is about to give you in order that you can listen to me and Jenny recommend some media that you should put into your ear holes, eye holes, and any other appropriate orifices. Siri, when should they jump to?
Time jump to 23 minutes, bitches.
Thank you, Siri.
I intended to watch this episode last night, actually, but I confess I haven't actually got around to it. I was alphabetizing my cheesies. So, Jenny, could you bring us up to speed on what happened in the episode?
Okay. So I was going to watch it. I was actually going to watch it first thing on Friday. And then I don't know if you saw, but there was that amazing interview and Oscar Isaac said he actually actively invited his fans to call him daddy. I think the quote is, you can call me daddy. And I lost like 3 days.
Okay.
I just went into like a fugue state.
So you haven't watched
imagining
either.
Imagining that.
You haven't watched either.
Reliving it.
So neither of us have watched
it. No, I haven't seen it. I'm sorry. Oh, no.
Well, that's suboptimal.
I mean, it's not great.
I mean, I guess the only possible way we could save this show is if there was an alternate timeline version of how Picard can be.
I mean, I'm sure there is a timeline in which we are not shambling wrecks.
There might be one slightly closer to the one that we are in where there are still some shambling wrecks, but they are better informed than we are. Mm. For example, a timeline in which a married Scottish couple, at least one of whom is also called Jenny, could break into our transmission and do a better job of this than we ever could.
I mean, that would be great. That would be ideal.
Incoming transmission from the evil alternative timeline where Scotland's premier Star Trek-related podcast is presented by a tired married couple, one of whom is called Jenny, which doesn't actually sound that different now that I come to think about it. But anyway, coming up later on this episode of Who's Picard Is It Anyway? We have a discussion of the need for more carpets on starships. Plus, Jenny will be talking about her idea about the spin-off series Starfleet HR. But first, I suppose we should talk about this week's episode of season 2 of Star Trek Picard. So, what did you think?
Okay, so I thought, and I should point out here that I'm going to sound more unprepared because I have just come in from being out for most of the evening, and Gordon has written a script in the meantime, which he's not told me about until we literally started recording this.
Just some notes to riff from. There's no script in the
There is literally a script.
There is not a script.
Okay, it's more preparation than I have managed to do. But what I thought about the episode was that we're kind of at possibly too many levels of Inception-like timeline within a timeline here. So to start off with, we're already in the normal Star Trek timeline, which is the future, obviously, from our perspective. And then from within that, we have gone into an alternative future from that future. And then from that alternative future, we have gone back into the past and then to a different
which is still our future from today,
but is the past. And then from that, we've gone to a different geographical location in the past. And then from that, we have gone back into Picard's own past, but mediated through the way Picard experiences it in the form of fairy tales, which is already about 7 steps removed from where we were at the beginning. And what I think it reminds me of, possibly triggered by having the guy who plays Boltar in it quite strongly, is what happened with Battlestar Galactica, where there were a lot of very beautifully written backstory on a backstory on an explanation on a motivation on a backstory, but underneath it, the Cylons did not actually have a plan, and it all kind of fell apart at the end because it didn't make sense. So I'm hoping that's not going to happen with Picard because I quite like this episode, but that's where I'm worried it's going to go. Over to you, man with script.
Not a script.
It's not actually a script. It's just more words written down than I have.
This episode is a tricky. I find this season quite frustrating. I really liked how it started. I thought it started really well. It got a really good bit of oomph to the first few episodes, but it seems to kind of slightly ground to a halt in what I can only assume is the writer's room favourite. But I can only assume the writer's room for this series really, really, really like Star Trek IV, the one where they save the whales, because so much of this, it is really good. But they've already made that in 1986, and they seem to be determined to make it again. We had the punk on the bus back 2 weeks ago. We were riffing on the line about Captain Kirk saying, I'm not from outer space, I'm from Io. I only work in outer space. And We've a great riff on that line in this episode about Chile as well. But it's just, we've done Star Trek IV. We don't need to do it again, particularly not as well, and over the course of multiple episodes. That just, it just seems to be, nothing really happened. Nothing really moved the plot on. And it was all, I mean, I really like the characters. I think the performances are really good, but the plot hasn't really moved forward. And I felt this episode was just a bit predictable. We hadn't met Picard's father yet. A mysterious man shows up. Who could he be? Oh, look, it is his dad. There's a surprise. I just feel it's got so much talent and energy and potential to it that just the last thing I want my Star Trek to be is predictable. And for me, this episode was overall pretty predictable.
It's one of the, what should be one of the advantages of having a short series in the Star Trek universe, or a relatively short series compared to traditional Star Trek season lengths, which I believe this is that you can tell quite a nice tight story within that if you choose to. And they're kind of not. I think I liked it more than Gordon did, but I feel that if it wasn't Patrick Stewart who can pull that off, I would be getting a bit fed up with the let's go deep inside Picard's consciousness to find out what's really going on here, when there's a lot of external things and spaceships and aliens and Borg really going on here that I would also quite like to see in my sci-fi programs.
Well, there certainly weren't very many spaceships in this episode, which was quite annoying.
Was one spaceship.
Well, there was
two spaceships.
There were some nice drawings.
Yes,
drawings
there was one real one.
I do like a bit more spaceships in my Star Trek as well. And they did go briefly into the La Serena. It's fine.
Talk about why it needs more carpets.
It doesn't. Well, this episode didn't need more carpets. There may well have been carpets that I wasn't paying enough attention. But my theory of starship design in the 24th century is the big thing that the Enterprise D had that was different from the starships that came before, and indeed different from the starships that came afterwards, was it was a nice place to live. You would want to live on that starship. It was comfortable. It was a bit like an 80s hotel, but there were curved lines, there was wood, there were nice carpets. It was a pleasant place to be. There were ramps, nothing, it wasn't lots of steps and things everywhere. As has been every bridge since. From an accessibility perspective, the Enterprise D is the best, which is around because when the ship, when Next Gen first started and I first saw the pictures of that ship design, I hated it. I hated the big oval shape of the primary hull as opposed to a nice circular shape like an Enterprise is supposed to be. But it has grown on me over the years. But I really like the interior design of that ship, and I'd like to see a little bit more in the way of nice carpets, nice wood, and just Starfleet and the future should be a nice place to be, where cool and interesting and dangerous things can happen, but you want to have a nice living environment, the ship you're living on, and that's something that the Enterprise D and Next Gen had that none of the other series really have captured since, and I include this in that lack of carpet complaint.
Yes, it feels more like a place to work when you're in space rather than a place you might consider home.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
Can I talk about the administrative
structures
behind? So one of the series that I would like to see, if we're going to do infinite number of Star Trek spin-offs, my theory is that any big organization of the size of the Federation or of Starfleet must have an absolutely massive administrative infrastructure and scaffolding to allow it to function. And you never get to see it. And it's the kind of thing that you should get to see because there must be some interesting stories there. Like, Voyager has a Q protocol for how you deal with Q. So somebody has been reading captain's logs based on the Next Generation crew's dealings with Q and gone, we need to put something in place here to deal with someone like this. So that's it working, though. What would be more interesting is to see what the Star Trek equivalent is of you're having a big meeting about how to deal with the Borg or a wormhole or the Cardassians or something. And there's one person in the corner who's just been on a Prince 2 project management course and wants to have everything to start with a project initiation document, and everybody else rolls their eyes. This has to happen. And yet we don't get to see it. And this is one of the things that I found frustrating as well about Battlestar Galactica, which I'm clearly going to keep coming back to because I have a very short frame of reference and was reminded by that, is that they did about three episodes of how do we function in this world where most of humanity has been destroyed and we're being chased by Cylons and we all live on spaceships and what kind of society do we run? And then they kind of went, well, it's fine, really. I guess we run out of fighter pilots. How do we cope? Oh, Leodama wants to be a lawyer. Oh, he can be a lawyer. It's fine. We don't actually need anybody running this place. So the Cylons didn't have a plan, but neither did the humans. And that's why I would like to see what the administrative framework behind the scenes looks like. And also, Kirk should have failed the Kobayashi Maru test, because your recruitment is frankly terrible. If you set up a recruitment test like that and he refuses to go by it, and you just go, gosh, what a brave hero, and let him through anyway. Nope, you should fail. Anyway.
So bringing it back to the episode at hand, I had a point I wanted to raise about the ending of the episode. They try and summon the Q, and young Guinan does all that.
I do like young Guinan. Yes, I like young Guinan.
The casting, as I say, is really good, I think, overall. I'm very impressed. I'm pleased they did not try and do a de-aged Whoopi Goldberg, because really unnecessary. Anyway, they try and summon Q, and Q does not turn up, which is interesting. And then mysterious FBI agent turns up and arrests them. Do you think he's actually an FBI agent, or is he some kind of like, super temporal agent come to... Is it a coincidence that they tried to summon Q and then he turned up?
Oh, you don't think we're going to be doing the here's like Q's extended family where all the other Q's come and get Q?
I don't know, but I just don't know that, why would the FBI X-Files apart be that interested in people? You shouldn't have been more of an NSA thing if it was an actual Earth thing that they were for some reason monitoring lanes for people beaming in randomly. Why would they immediately assume that's someone from space if he didn't already know there was something else going on? I just feel there's more to him than just we've just decided to arrest Picard to create an end of the episode cliffhanger.
Presumably this future isn't that temporally distinguished from ours, and so there's probably no actual crime against materializing in the middle of nowhere. And presumably the FBI needs some kind of warrant even in this future. You can't just be like, something's off there, let's go and arrest him.
Well, as with Rios in the early episodes, he will be an illegal alien with no papers to show he's allowed to be in the United States, and he's allegedly French, so...
Are you going to look at what politics is like in France at this point in the future?
Where's your green card? Well, the other episode, this episode that was a bit disappointing was the lack of progress of the Borg Queen doing terribly much, apart from dramatically breaking a window.
She glared at people.
Yes, and dramatically broke a window. And it wasn't even a very big or exciting window. It was just, it seemed to be a bit more pretentious than it kind of warranted. So that was a bit odd. But and it's also the world's slowest assimilation she seems to be going under from Dr. Jurati. But I have a theory though for what's going on, which is just a theory and I haven't read any spoilers, I don't know, but in the first episode when they're on the ship, when the Borg attack or apparently attack and there's the weird looking Borg Queen with a mask on and they say, well, that's very weird, have a Borg Queen with a mask. Why would you have a mask? You don't want someone to see your face. So I think that Borg Queen in the first episode is Borgified Jurati, who is turning into the Borg Queen and is actually coming forward in time to try and rescue them or to rescue herself and is not actually trying to destroy them. But anyway, that's my theory, is the Borg Queen in the first episode is Borg Queen stroke Jurati, who we are gradually seeing forming now. That's my theory.
Okay. Do we then have like two Borg Queens or just a Borg Queen at two points in time?
There appear to be multiple Borg Queens generally.
Oh, I think the whole idea of the Borg Queen was a bit far in the first place, honestly, but
do you obviously need to move on to the other part of the podcast where we recommend media we have watched or consumed in the last week, and things that are
watch much because we are also very, very tired.
Precisely. I went to the cinema and saw an actual film, a film in the actual cinema, and it was actually really fun. It's The Bad Guys, which is an animated, basically, if you imagine Ocean's 11 made animated and for kids, it's that film, and it's not Pixar standard brilliant, but it's good fun, it's entertaining, some good visuals, some good jokes, some good voices. I really enjoyed it, and so did our 8-year-old, and it was well worth the money. So, The Bad Guys.
The Bad Guys.
And it's not as saccharine or as... It judges the tone quite nicely, basically. We have been watching some Sopranos.
We have.
So that's just how far back we are in terms of catching up with television.
We're like on season two of The Sopranos that everybody else finished in like 1999 or something.
Well, I've never seen The Sopranos before. And the thing that surprised me about it that I'm enjoying is how funny it is. I thought it was a show that took itself a lot more seriously than it seems to. I'm really enjoying the humour in it.
Yeah, I saw bits and pieces of it throughout its run and have mostly forgotten it. So I'm kind of enjoying watching it through from the start, although I feel that we're perhaps not watching it fast enough to remember who everybody is. So it still confuses me quite a lot.
They'll be dead in a minute, it's fine. If you just wait long enough, they get killed off. It doesn't seem to be a problem.
Are we watching anything else?
My final suggestion for something to watch was, again, is a show from a few years ago, but we kind of rediscovered recently, which is really, really good and is available to watch on Amazon Prime, but you have to buy it, which is a bit annoying, is The Middleman.
Oh, yeah, but it's worth buying. If you haven't seen The Middleman, it's really good. It's It's short.
It's only one series like, that got cancelled.
Terribly, unfairly.
It's up there in the high regard of single series shows that got cancelled and shouldn't have, but are really, really good. It was on ABC Family originally. I don't think it particularly found an audience, but it's just a really nicely done. Again, they get the tone really right. It's just a lovely show.
How do you describe it?
It's kind of the X-Files meets Men in Black.
Meets my idea of a kind of sci-fi fantasy administrative framework underneath it.
Yes, exactly. And it's about a character called the Middleman who solves exotic problems along with his female companion. And they work for an organization called the Organization Too Secret to Know, OSTK. It's a hard show to describe, but it's highly recommended. Seek it out, The Middleman.
It's also maybe worth mentioning that when The Middleman was first, because it was a graphic novel first, and this kind of came at the peak of really gritty superhero movies, and it's a kind of backlash to that grittiness backlash. So The Middleman as a superhero is, while very funny in a way, he's also not a typical superhero of his period, I would say.
He's very nice.
He drinks milk.
Yes. In a threatening fashion.
And he's not the one in charge, he's just the middleman.
That's probably a good point to wrap things up, to return control to the prime timeline, if such a thing still exists, or indeed are we in the prime timeline now? Who can tell? Goodbye.
Goodbye.
A new low, then, for how Picard can it be, achieving a record not percent Picard from the actual host of this podcast.
From HQ, yeah. It's not great, is it? But mercifully.
Thank God for Jenny and Gordon.
That was wonderful. Thank you.
It was very good. And actually, continuing my an hour tradition of being absolutely pants this episode, happily, when I asked Gordon for a couple of bullet points for how we could introduce the two of them, he gave me full paragraphs. So I'm just going to read them out.
Wow.
Gordon works in trying to save interesting old buildings, was once called a boffin in the national press, likes old computers, retro computing, likes old cinemas, retro, because that's tautological, likes old cinemas, retro computing, the Muppets, and watches more CBeebies than is healthy for a man of his age. Unusually, in the siloed worlds of fandom, he enjoys all of Doctor Who, Star Trek, and Star Wars. Did Doctor Who restart?
They just had an Easter special that's caused quite the ripple on Twitter.
Although he thinks that DS9 is canonically the best Trek series, Next Gen is the nicest. His Q credentials are that he once met John Delancey at a Star Trek convention in Glasgow. Are we the only people who have not met?
I feel like everyone's met him.
Jenny, the other Jenny, the better Jenny, is a civil servant with interest in policy and administration, something that may become relevant later, brackets foreshadowing, except it's kind of past shadowing.
Yeah, really.
This is we're introducing them after they've been on. She likes tropical fish, spaceships, cryptic crosswords, and is not ashamed to have a proper gamer's laptop with coloured flashing lights on it and everything. She hates the sound of her own voice and will not be listening to this podcast, so we can say anything about her we like and she won't know about it.
Ah.
Jenny and Gordon are married, brackets to each other, important clarification there, have two children and two cats and are very, very tired. As will become clear, they are also podcast virgins. Well, Gordon and Jenny, it was not clear that you hadn't done this before.
No.
That was excellent.
Yeah, you should have a well, I don't actually want you to have a podcast because you'd be better than us. I feel like you're taking our USP slightly.
I will say that off mic, Gordon sent me a little sample to make sure that the mic they were using was okay. And off mic, on the cutting room floor, in the same place on the cutting room floor as you find us bickering about microphones, there was also some bickering about microphones. It's nice to see that it really does follow through.
There is nothing that annoys me more than being criticized on my microphone technique. It just really rubs me the wrong way.
But it was a really good summary of the episode.
So I've got several things to say. Let me say it first. No, just let me talk. Gordon, love his Twitter. You should definitely follow it. Loads of really interesting stuff about old cinemas.
Yeah, linked to in the show notes.
Yeah, if you're interested in sort of cinema history and old buildings in general, there's some great stuff there. Jenny makes an excellent point, which is I would watch the shit out of a show that yep. was Star Trek HR.
Yeah, when
they must have so much, like, they're always banging on about these various policies. Like, I want to see those being hashed out.
As she was talking, I was like, Jenny's gonna fucking love this, because it is like space admin is one of the best genres. Like, whenever there's a disaster movie, yeah. I always really tune into, like, what would they actually do? What's the protocols? Remember, one of my favorite moments from West Wing is when the hospital. When the red phone rings.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And what happens is the president's been shot. Spoilers. I told you there's spoilers. The president's been shot. And it cuts at one point to a sort of quite calm, you know, late night ER. Mm. And the nurses are all going around, the administrators are all going around just doing their sort of business. And the phone starts to ring, and she picks up the phone to answer it. But it's not that phone. It's a phone that never rings.
It's the phone next to it.
It's the red phone.
It's the and red, like,
that shit,
presidential
man,
phone.
Still, like, I've watched that scene a half a dozen times, still yeah. absolute chill.
And don't you love it? I don't know, because you don't work in a public facing building at the moment, yep. but we have a few protocols in the building yes. I work in for emergency situations, like code words and stuff. I just love it. I love all that stuff. You can't say them out loud.
No.
Okay.
But we used to live in London. This is really obvious.
Well, everyone knows this, though. Yeah.
But the thing that always amused me is when we lived in London, we took the tube quite a lot. You would hear various announcements of the tannoy mm-hmm. for, you know, mind the gap or whatever it was. but it would always be like pretty broad London accents, which is a broad sweep of accents. It's not like a London accent, but it would always be quite a broad sweep of, you know, sort of blue collar working class London accents. But then occasionally you'd hear, "Would Inspector Sands please come to the Would Inspector Sands," which meant there was a fire. That's famously the code word for fire. But it was delivered in this like beautiful RP. It's like, yeah, that's a code word. First time you hear it, it's obvious.
There's a really funny Michelin Web sketch where Olivia Colman is the voice and she's like, "Inspector Sands is sicking up some smoke." It's really funny. But yeah, no, I absolutely agree. I would just love that. Yeah. Star Trek HR. Also, Jenny, I don't know why you don't like your voice. It's great.
Yeah, absolutely beautiful voice.
Fantastic voice.
I particularly liked from their summary, I think it's very obvious perhaps, but I completely agree that I will be astonished if both the masked queen does not turn out to be Jurati.
Yeah, agree.
But also that what appeared to be her breaking the ship, you know, the tentacles smashing into control.
She's trying to help.
She was trying to help. And that will be the twist. But it was good stuff.
We're definitely going to get thrown back into that weird masked queen situation. Yeah. It was really good. Wasn't
it? I think it was Jenny made the point that the timelines are becoming a little interleaved and
we got confused, remember?
Easily confused. But I think the point is, just don't care about it too much. Just kind of go along for the ride.
But don't care about it too much until you have to summarize it for an audience, and then like maybe care a little bit.
So we will watch that episode and the next episode before we come round to doing next week's show.
Yeah.
It's a bit like, you know, when you sort of, you know, don't put the bins out one week. I think we'll do it.
Terrible metaphor. We're alienating everyone.
So let's move then to the segment of the show where we recommend media for you. And I've got three bits.
Thank God.
You've got two?
I mean, I might have one and a half.
I mean, last week you recommended
crisps.
Crisps and almost sleeping, just as sort of general concept. So I've got three bits of media to recommend for you. Two of which, the first and the last, are written bits of media. And this is the first one I want to bring up, in particular in the context of Jenny and Gordon, who are those weird internet friends we have. Like, they weren't people we know. I think they were your friends first through Twitter. And then,
I can't remember. Yeah, I guess
we have met them.
Probably once? Doctor Who friends. I think they were Doctor Who friends. Yeah, we met them at CBeebies.
For CBeebies Panto.
CBeebies Panto. Always on brand.
And this first story was actually recommended into my timeline by our pal Jack Brewster. Again, somebody we know through Twitter. I don't even know what Jack looks like because his avatar is an emoji type character.
I thought that's what he looked like.
I don't even know. I've seen like sort of sides of his face.
Maybe he looks like Jabba the Hutt, we just don't know.
But it was recommended into, and this is relevant, right? So this is a piece by Michelle Catalano, and it's about the relationships you have through Twitter. And you're going to have to indulge me as I read out two paragraphs, just two paragraphs, okay. But that's what it is. She was talking about how Twitter in particular can flatten relationships so that you can reach out directly to musicians or celebs, you know, and maybe they'll write back to you and that kind of stuff. And she says, I was thinking about this when I tweeted out a small thread last week about how much I appreciate my followers. I've had a rough time of it lately. A surprise separation and subsequent divorce put me in a tailspin. Twitter was there for me. The friends I made in that space came to my rescue immediately, sending tweets of support, DMing to check up on me, texting me words of encouragement. Every time I had a moment of despair, I'd tweet about it, and my friends would rally around me and make me feel better. For all the bad rap Twitter gets, it's been a good space for me, a place where I can let go of emotions, where I can say what's on my mind and in my heart, and have people who have grown to care about me by my side. It's been better than therapy in some instances, and I'm incredibly grateful for it. Since joining Twitter in 2007, it's become my main avenue of socialisation. I don't go out much, I don't hang out in groups, I don't have a lot of offline friends, I prefer being home on my couch to most other activities. I like my physical privacy and need a wide swath of space, wide swathe of space around me. So hanging out in bars or at parties isn't my thing. Yet I enjoy conversing with people. I like both intellectually stimulating conversation and talking about simpler things. I like to talk sports. I love telling jokes and making people laugh. And I love even more listening to people be funny. Twitter allows me to do all that without the burden of having to be uncomfortable in a large group of people. If I ever left Twitter, as I think of sometimes doing, I would leave all those daily conversations and laughs behind. And I really resonated with that. Those parasocial relationships, those friendships you make online, and that's that curation of those people who you surround yourself with, and they're always there for you. That line, I've just thrown a bit of paper on the ground, so I'm going to have to squint at this. People who have grown to care about me. That's a really powerful line, I think.
It's very powerful, and I think I see a lot of people talking about, particularly Twitter, but it can be any social media site, really as a kind of hellscape, which it definitely can be, but I think it very much depends who you're following. And there have been two instances in which, well, so I absolutely agree about particularly what resonated with me there was the, I need physical, what did it say?
A large swathe of physical space around me.
I definitely need that. And as a kind of anxiety sufferer, I really struggle in social situations where I don't have a quick exit.
Yeah.
I find that very, very difficult. And obviously on social media or on the internet, if I need an exit, I just shut down my phone.
Put the phone down.
Which is great. Whereas if you're in a pub, it's, I'm going home now. Why? Oh, just stay for one more. Why? Yeah. And that's stressful. I need a quick excuse to get the hell out of there if I'm not happy. And yeah, that's never underestimate that. There have been two instances where social media has like almost been a lifesaver for me. One was, do you remember when I was readmitted to hospital a few days after my daughter was born? I just did a very like lighthearted sort of woe is me tweet about it. It was just like two sentences. And people were so lovely. I said, please make me laugh. This is horrible. And people were just lovely and strange. People I'd never met. Your friend Susie sent me like a Starbucks voucher for when I got out of hospital. And people just sent me like funny gifts and everything was so lovely. And then a lot of other friendships, like when I've been at very low ebb, like Jim, our friend Jim, introduced me to Hamilton at a point where I was basically staying in bed most of the day, either in bed or holding a baby in my dressing gown. Every day, all day, and things like that. You know, God, I can't imagine.
And I think there's something really special not having that. About. I mean, to an extent, what we're describing is friendships, right?
Yeah,
so that's kind of silly, but there is absolutely something about the fact that there is an amorphous mass of people who have come. What was it like? I can't remember. Who've come to care about you?
Mm.
Who are kind of just bubbling away? Like you don't have to. Right, let's meet in the pub on Friday at 4.
There's no demand.
There's no demand. I really like that. I think the only thing I'd say in warning around that is when I tweeted that story out this week, I put a coda on it, which was, my God, can we not get through an episode of this show without talking about coda? I put a coda on it, which was, I wonder about my ability to socialise. I used to absolutely love, when we worked at Future in particular, going down from the office to the Cork, the pub that was underneath the building, having a few drinks, sometimes quite a few drinks.
Yeah.
And in part, that's my old pre-parental life.
Yeah, I don't know if that's so much to do with social media. It's just we don't work above
a
pub.
I mean, that's definitely part of it. And there's not the culture of that here at DC Thompson, where I currently work. But also, I definitely don't have that loose familiarity with physical in-person socializing anymore. And partly that's pandemic, partly that's parenthood, part of that, I suspect, is getting older. Like, we know there's an endemic of, like, men in particular who just fail to make friendships in their old age. But thank Christ for Twitter and things like it.
Yeah, it's fantastic.
For amazing people that are around.
And, like, round the clock. But
round the clock, yeah, for sure. Time zones.
It definitely is. Like, I'm working off, when I wasn't in office full time in my pre-parent days, it was very stressful. Like, knowing that someone was going to say, you're coming to the pub, and thinking, I don't have a good out for this, but I don't really want to. But, like, it's a way for very sort of unsociable people to be sociable, to enjoy that, like, relaxed and easy familiarity in a space you can drop in and out of. It's really interesting. If you're not enjoying social media, you're probably
following the wrong people.
Following arseholes.
Or you're too attuned, too in the thrall of the algorithm. Like, I found when I've been setting up the Twitter account for e-bike Nugs, my little e-bike account, the push that it puts on you to, like, be following topics, to be, you know, somebody tweeted this, and all, you know, it's very algo driven. But if, like, you and I very tightly curate the list of people we follow, and we're pretty free and easy with the mute button, like, just put them in mute jail for a few weeks, you're getting too much. But people are there.
I went through this phase of wanting to, like, make more, sort of just hear more voices and make more friends. And I started to do this thing when, if anyone followed me, or if anyone liked something I'd said, or if I liked something someone else had said, instead of just liking, I would follow them. And then if I'd check the profile first to make sure they weren't, like, a neo-Nazi, I would follow them back. If I then didn't like what they were, you know, if I didn't like what they were saying, I'd unfollow. But if they were just a bit boring, I would just mute them.
Yeah.
And it's just, I think
a different way of socializing.
Mute and unfollow as much as possible, and then you find yourself with just, like, quite a small group. I think I only follow, like, 500 people.
Yeah, I'm somewhere about 600.
I don't follow any celebrities, or if I do, I mute them just so that, you know, I've kind of got them on my radar.
But the piece by Michelle Catalano itself is very good. It's linked in the show notes. I really recommend going to have a read of it. What can you recommend to the boys and girls, Jennifer?
I was going to recommend something that's a little bit hyper-local, but you might have heard of it, and I'm not sure if it might tour elsewhere. So keep your peepers peeled if you're not in reach of Dundee. And that's the V&A Dundee's current exhibition, Michael Clark, Cosmic Dancer. It's a really interesting exhibition, quite different for V&A Dundee. I haven't really seen an exhibition like that. I would say in Scotland, I haven't really seen an exhibition like that ever. So Michael Clark is a Scottish kind of multi-hyphenate, so dancer, choreographer, kind of cultural icon that worked a lot in the 80s and worked a lot in the sphere of other, like, pop culture people of that time. Mark E. Smith, Sarah Lucas, Lee Bowery, like, all a lot of these cultural, like, late 80s, early 90s people. And V&A Dundee's got a fantastic retrospective, not only of Michael Clark's work, so a lot of video work, but of costumes he designed, or costumes designed for him, work inspired by him. There's a fantastic Sarah Lucas sculpture of him, alongside some of her other works of that period. It's absolutely, like, labyrinthine exhibition. It's, like, packed with, like, paintings, drawings, videos, posters, interviews, loads of really interesting stuff. And I was, like, I almost got lost in there. There's so much to see for what is... I checked, just do a little name check here. I checked with Leonie, the director, when I went to the media preview. Not that she knew who I was. I was like, hi, I'm Jenny. I said, is this a bigger space? So if you've ever seen any of the other V&A Dundee exhibitions, it's exactly the same space, but it feels a lot, lot bigger. And it's like, it is like a maze. It's like sort of corridors opening up into galleries, you know, closing back down into corridors. And it's really interesting. Loads of great sounds and costumes and colours and lights. Little bit of a content warning for children, but I mean, I think, you know, I would take my child in there.
And indeed we did.
Extremely comfortable, like, saying that, you know, sometimes costumes are revealing. Lovely, fantastic stuff.
Yeah, it was beautiful. I think you could fall in love with the staging of the exhibition as much as the content.
Because it's loads of neon and vinyl.
Loads of neon, vinyl, brash, bold, 80s color palettes and stuff, but really, really super, super engaging.
The other thing, I have recommended this, I think, 2 weeks ago, but it's coming out soon, and I just want to double down on that, which is The Unbearable Weight of Massive Talent. You will see some buses, and you will see some trailers, and you will see a lot of GIFs. Lionsgate are doing some very exciting marketing. You might remember their last exciting marketing campaign was Knives Out. So I'm kind of hoping favorites. It's the same... I'm hoping it's the same team on this one because I very much enjoyed Knives Out marketing. So yeah, Nicolas Cage is Nicolas Cage. It's so funny and so weird and so mad. You have to try and see if you can. It's very funny.
What do you make of Everything Everywhere All at Once?
I'm quite excited about it.
The reason I bring it up
mixed
is...
mixed reviews.
It was into my feed today, Twitter feed. Call back from there's a tweet from Ed Zitron who says Hollywood astounded by new type of movie, quote, good movie that people enjoy. And he was quote he was quote tweeting a Bloomberg reporter, Lucas Shaw, who said, Everything Everywhere All at Once, an R-rated movie with no superheroes, no stars, and no real genre, posted the highest per screen average of any movie this year, which is a slightly odd metric to use in these still sort of slightly post-COVID-y, during COVID-y times.
I feel like that's this in the same vein. Like, I feel like I haven't seen a thoroughly enjoyable movie.
Yeah, but it reminded me a little bit of the sort of narrative I had around Coda as well.
Yeah.
Which was just like, it's just really a good film.
Even stuff like, I haven't seen some of the other big releases, like I didn't see Bond or anything, but yeah, even what should have been an absolute romp, Spider-Man No Way Home, was pretty heart-rending in places.
So staying in the cinema then, my second recommendation is actually a callback to Gordon's, which was The Bad Guys.
Oh, yes!
Which I saw this week with Ada as well. And like Gordon, I really enjoyed it. It was, I mean, it's a kid's film, right?
So advert made me laugh.
I'm not enjoying it necessarily even as much as I would enjoy a Pixar. Like, I guess like I would sit down and watch Luca. I would sit down and watch Coco.
Yeah.
I don't think I would sit down on my own and watch The Bad Guys, but it's equally not just a kind of schlocky, pump them out, stack them high, sell them cheap kids film.
It's enjoyable.
It's incredibly energetic, but not zany. It has beautiful animation. The story is just cracking. Like, I mean, it's a fairly basic villain story, but it's really well done.
Ada was trying to explain it to me today, and that's really confusing.
And one thing I will say is it took me a long time to place the voice of the villain. And it's mad.
Is the villain a bad guy or a good guy in The Bad Guys?
I mean, again, spoilers. He's positioned as a good guy at the start, but he's really evil. And it's Richard Ayoade.
Ah.
Now, Richard Ayoade has one of the most recognisable voices in media across the world, across all time.
Got a hot ear.
But I didn't place him originally. And I was like, oh, Dickie, you can do range. It was really good. But it was thoroughly enjoyable. It was a bit like, I said to you, Penguin were doing some tweets about, can you guess who's voicing our new audiobooks? One of them was voiced by James Acaster. Again, like, one of the most James distinctive voices.
Who else could it be?
Possibly imagine. But no, The Bad Guys, if you've got kids under 10, I would submit, maybe even slightly over 10, or you just feel like watching something really fun, it was far better than it ever needed to be.
I find that about a lot of things. I thought Ron's Gone Wrong was far better than it needed to be as well. God bless. If you are a movie studio that's made a family film that everyone can literally enjoy, like mums, dads and kids, yep, can all enjoy on some level.
And without necessarily the sort of like...
I don't want jokes to go over my child's head.
Exactly, that kind of tedious, like, adult wink, wink, nudge, nudge,
no, no,
tits akimbo.
Actual funny jokes.
Yeah.
Then you have probably saved a lot of households a lot of pain during the pandemic, because Jesus Christ.
Let's wrap up then with my last recommendation, which is the work of a colleague of mine, Alex Watson, who's head of comment for the Press and Journal, who's written a really good piece in the last week called Don't Dismiss Cities That Fought to Rebuild from Nothing. You haven't read this, I don't think.
No, I don't think I have.
And I was going to read it out to you. And then I was like, hang on a minute. I know Alex. Alex is a podcaster. She has her own podcast about Louis Theroux, on which Louis Theroux has himself appeared.
Does she?
Let me tell you.
If I had a podcast about Chris Evans, would Chris Evans be on it? Or Oscar Isaac, daddy?
The name of the podcast pretty much writes itself. So I DM'd Alex earlier tonight and said to him, would you mind reading out the first half of that story so that we can respond to it? So here is Alex Watson giving us an exclusive read of her story, Don't Dismiss Cities That Fought to Rebuild from Nothing, in the Press and Journal this week.
During spring 2020, I dreamed of cities. Lockdown in flats without gardens, I'm sure many people at that time longed desperately for wide open spaces. Forests, beaches, mountains. When I needed calm, I closed my eyes and imagined walking through Manhattan streets in the quiet and pale early morning. I wrote about sun-drenched summer days in Glasgow's Kelvin Grove Park and wanted to climb into the page. I pictured myself sipping black coffee and curiously watching life go by from a Parisian pavement cafe. In her novel Heartburn, Nora Ephron was talking about New York when she wrote, I look out the window and I see the lights and the skyline and the people on the street rushing around looking for action, love and the world's greatest chocolate chip cookie, and my heart does a little dance. But that's exactly how I find myself feeling about every single city I'm lucky enough to visit. It's not just the shiny, bustling metropolises immortalised 1,000 times in films. It's all of them. I have a soft spot for Dundee, for Aberdeen, for Sheffield, to name a few favourites. I've yet to find a city I don't like. I know plenty of people don't agree because they tell me, whether with words or eye rolls or little derisive scoffs. But I'm a big fan of those smaller, hardy cities, once titans of old school industry, that were left to rot and simply refused. Instead, they evolved into unique cultural hubs with so much to offer. Empty warehouses transformed into pubs, food markets, recording studios, world-renowned museums, excelling sports teams, well-established universities and art scenes, attracting all kinds of brilliance. Madchester reverberated across the world. Sheffield alone has given us Pulp, Arctic Monkeys and the sensational Self-Esteem, for goodness sake. I honestly believe Aberdeen is well on its way to a renaissance after its own tough time. Some of the Granite City's harshest critics are its own residents. I'm not sure if they truly believe it or if they've internalised the condemnation unfairly hurled by outsiders. But as one of those outsiders invited in, here's what I see. There's stunning architecture, a beautiful beach, a fiercely beloved football team, an abundance of incredible art, cool and unique festivals, an increasingly exciting food and drink scene. What more does a city need?
Thank you, Alex. And in fact, in that piece, she then goes on to pivot to talk about the impact of the war in Ukraine and about how cities can rebuild and keep their soul. But the point, even in that first half, is so well made, I think.
That was lovely. I completely agree. And I particularly, it's really difficult talking to people who have been to Dundee 20 years ago, talking about living there now, because it's almost like a pity, like, oh God, sorry you live there. But it's like, no, it's fantastic. It's great. We've got so much to do and it's free and it's not mobbed with tourists. Yeah. It's just nice and interesting and everyone will have a go at anything because everything's up for grabs.
Yeah. I think Alex's point as well about the joy of cities in general, that sort of bustling nature and the one of our great joys when we lived in London was, you know, going out early and getting breakfast, sitting in the street and watching the city come alive. That sense of just folk doing stuff and the exactly as you say, people have a go at it. I mean, you see just that constant kind of reinvention and I want to say the word hunger, but that implies kind of rapaciousness that I don't like. It's not a kind of avaricious hunger. It's not like, I want all that. It's just like, let's do better. Let's keep moving. Let's move forward.
I find as well in a city that's kind of, I wouldn't say Dundee's hit rock bottom, but I'd say Dundee's certainly had tough times as its traditional industries have kind of gone, is that local people and people generationally of the city are fairly open to new things. I mean, things like the V&A have of, you know, new things always have criticism, but people are generally quite open to ideas. Mm. Whereas when we lived in Bath, which was a very thriving tourist destination, going back a long way, I find that people who were comfortable living there, particularly people of a certain generation, very opposed to change. So I remember they tried to build some affordable housing in Bath and people protested. and things like that. So it's really nice even to see that, yeah, a bit more resistant to new things and change traditionally. But it's nice to see that our friends Anne and Jim are doing things like the Natural Theatre Company and trying to sort of push those boundaries a little bit. But yeah, in when you live in a city that's had tough times, people are quite sort of, oh, okay, what can we try now?
Yeah, I think that's really true. It's a really bootstrappy kind of place.
Yeah.
And you look at things like Creative Dundee and the networks that are starting to spring up, they are not grand national schemes. They are very grassroots, peer-supporting ways of doing things. And, you know, if you look at what Creative Dundee in particular is doing, if you want to be part of that community of creatives, you will be expected to pull your own weight and to help others as much as you can get out help for yourself.
Yeah, so like there's Amps Dundee, which is that part of Creative Dundee, yep. And like I think you pay a fiver, yeah. But as part of that you get to be represented in a lot of their sort of events, but then you're also expected to like share your knowledge and like share something that you've learned. This has been the most preachy and po-faced podcast. We're meant to be having fun.
I'm having fun.
Well, I know you
I don't know if the readers are having fun.
I mean, Jenny and Gordon are just, they did it a lot better than us. What are we doing now? We're just telling people that they're doing everything wrong.
I mean, the good thing is there's only like two or three episodes left.
Jesus Christ, right. Next week, we're going to come back. No one's going to mention the war in Ukraine.
Would you like a buzzer?
Yeah, I would like a buzzer. I'm going to have a buzzer. And whenever something too serious comes up, I'm going to hit it. And you're going to have to make a pun. Ridiculous.
Pun on the spot.
No one listens. If they want to listen to this, they'd listen to fucking Newsnight.
I mean, that certainly, we're very close to Newsnight. I mean, we're really, the Venn diagram overlaps basically a circle.
It's, I mean, if they wanted to hear about the issues of today.
Yeah.
They would be tuning in to us. I'm sorry, okay?
Thank you so much for listening. Thank you especially to Jenny and to Gordon.
Yeah, especially to those guys. What the hell would we do without them? It'd just be us reading stuff off the internet. I mean, it'd be us, as if people can Google.
It would be us covering a show that we haven't watched is what it would be about then. And thank you to Alex for at the very last minute providing some audio for a very good piece.
Thank you, Alex, that was excellent.
It really was. Thank you for listening. We will see you next week for, I'm not going to promise anything that's going to be better than that, but we will at least put some shite out.
Oh, daddy.